So over the next 3 weeks, we're going to take a journey together. I would really like to encourage you, if possible, to make it out for all 3 weeks. We're following a thread. Doesn't mean that if you miss one, you're going to be lost. But there is a place that we're going to go together over the next few weeks. And if you can't come, then please be checking on your app to be listening if possible, because I believe that this is very, very important. In the right up in the bulletin, it talks about worship being the central characteristic of following Jesus, of the Christian life. And I absolutely believe that. I absolutely believe that our relationship with Jesus is where we succeed or fail as human beings. And all of the rest, all of the other measurements that we might associate with whether or not we are being contributing members of society, those are not irrelevant, or it's not that we're not to consider those things, but the main lens, are we winning as humans, is essentially boils down to, are we following Jesus? Are we worshiping him? So this week, it was so funny. I was just trying to prepare, and I thought, where do I begin with this? Because it's such a broad conversation. We are going to touch in on why we do some of the things that we do on a regular basis, on a weekly basis, with our singing together and our common language that we have. Worship is huge. It is a huge conversation. It encompasses everything. And so I thought, where do I begin? And as like a launching pad, right, for this week. And so I was led to Romans 12, which is, I'll just pull it up here. And so, dear brothers and sisters, I plead with you to give your bodies to God because of all he has done for, oh, no, that's not the right one. I skipped something. Let's go back. There we go. Is that? Hallelujah. Okay. So, dear brothers and sisters, I plead with you to give your bodies to God because of all he has done for you. Let them be a living and holy sacrifice, the kind he will find acceptable. This is truly the way to worship him. Don't copy the behavior and customs of this world, but let God transform you into a new person by changing the way you think. Then you will learn to know God's will for you, which is good and pleasing and perfect. And the real sort of synthesis for me was this idea: bring your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and acceptable, which is how some translations render that text. This is your act of spiritual worship, is that's the way that other translations render it, and that's what we often will quote from. And so this came to mind, and I thought, excellent. That is a good place to start building a talk from. And then I started leaning into it, and I just never left. This is such rich language, and I missed it, and I've missed it many times as I've read this. This is so rich. Do you know that I started to lean in and started to ask some questions of the wider scholarly community within the Vineyard? And they sent me some papers, some trusted friends, just to read and reflect on this well. Do you know that this week I've read between 50 and 60 pages of academic papers, just on this text, and hardly even touched what's out there? It was brilliant. It was brilliant. And so we're going to spend our morning on this language, in this language, because wherever else we go, having a sense of why we do what we do, who we are, who God is, what this exchange is that's taking place, and what we're called to in the midst of our activity of worship is what makes the activity of worship significant. Because it is possible to go through the motions of Christian worship, and even the most fantastic, dynamic, all encompassing environments where the music surrounds us and our spirits begin to soar and our imaginations start to come alive, these can be empty, empty times. And that's why we run the risk sometimes of mistaking the hype of a great concert with the power of a deep encounter with God. And it's really important that we recognize those things. Now, is it possible to have a rocking time in the presence of God and have a transformative experience in the midst of pounding bass and soaring vocals and people who are around us that are passionately expressing movement? Yes, absolutely that is true. But it can be bereft of the Spirit of God, those things. Our foundation is so important. It's what empowers the rest of it. It's what makes the rest of it transformative. Because our worship can in some ways be measured, the fruit of it can be measured by the transformative power of our encounter with God. John Wimber is one of the things, and he's one of our founding sort of people within the Vineyard movement, within our context. And he, Tim, you might be able to get this quote better. I think it was him. Was it, you know, actually, help me out, because I think you're the one who, I don't care how much you shake. Is it how straight you walk when you get up? Was that? Yeah. So it's like you can shake and bake all you want. You can have, you can be drunk in the spirit. You can laugh for 6 hours. You can do all of those things that are wild and crazy. And we go, what? When we see it. And there can be wonderful things that can take place in that. But the only thing that really matters in the middle of it is how do we walk away from that encounter? Right? How do we walk away as followers, as worshipers? So anyway, that's why this is an important framework, I believe, where we're starting this morning, because it empowers the rest of the things that we're drawn to. Many of us are drawn to worship. I also, as just a way of sort of putting this out there, I recognize this is not a talk about music. We are going to weave the language of creativity into this. We are going to talk about why we do some of the things that we do. But I want to say that if you are not moved by the worship that we experience, this is a part of our problem, is that we call our singing time our worship time, right? That's helpful shorthand, but lousy long-term thinking, right? Because it really reduces the act of worship to this one thing. If you're not a music person and music doesn't do it for you, you're not wrong or broken. I just want to make sure that you hear that. I think that there can still be value even if you're not really somebody who gets moved by worship, and we're going to talk about where that value can be. But I just want to acknowledge that some of us, like, you know, there's a groove and we just start like moving, right? And then we start feeling stuff. You're not wrong if that's not you. That's really important to know. So let's start to dig into this text a little bit from Romans. This opening passage here. And so, dear brothers and sisters, I plead with you to give your bodies to God because of all he has done for you. As I've read through some of the various commentaries on this and been leaning into the language, it's so funny. I begin to recognize how much is being said that is difficult to capture in a translation. And so is sort of a word like therefore. It's a transitionary word. It kind of means, given everything that that has been said so far, we now declare this, right? And in the book of Romans, it is a powerful letter that was written, and I recommend reading it in its totality. We've talked about that in the past. It can be read all in one sitting. It takes but an hour or so. It's a powerful, powerful letter, written by Paul, who was an apostle in the earliest church. But the first portion of this entire letter that he's written, what it does is it disqualifies everybody in the room from the promises of God based on our own activities, and then reintroduces everybody in the room back into those promises through the work of Jesus. Right? So we get disqualified because we've all fallen short. None of us have cut it. You know, we're on par with the worst of sinners. And then the saving work of Jesus comes into that narrative, and it all becomes about his work and his activity and his saving power and his work on the cross, and we're all invited back. There's an invitation that's presented to everyone. And it says, therefore, so that's all the Jesus, that's all emphasis on Jesus' work. Therefore, let's talk about our labor. Let's talk about our response. Let's talk about our work. And then there's this wonderful, and so, dear brothers and sisters, given all this, family, there's this close language. It is not the language of somebody who's like coming as a professional, who's coming as a power monger, who's coming as a controller. It's the language of family, right? It's the language of intimate. Now, brothers, right? If we say that, listen, if I say that to a friend, and not in the churchy sense, but in the brother, it's like, you're a comrade, right? I'm like, brother, man, I look what's on your face right now. That feels a lot more close than if I say, you know, I'm going to drop that because I'm not making that connection well with my language. But you know what I mean, I think. There's language in it that's familiar, that's immediate. And then he says, I plead with you. And that can sound a little bit like desperation. But what it is it's this gentle language that says, come alongside, come and follow, come and, this is, come. It's the language of invitation, and it is, again, very, very personal. It's very gentle. It is sort of a hallmark of Paul's writing. There's this, like, other translations might say, I exhort you, which, again, is very, very strong. And it is strong in its emphasis because it's important, but it's gentle in its delivery. It's this thing of, come, let me show you. It's that kind of tone that's coming through this language. And then we get into this really interesting thing. I invite you, this is my sort of my paraphrase down below. I invite you to offer your bodies as an act of total surrender to God in response to everything he has given for you. Now, some translations, again, talk about giving our all. Because there is this element where our worship is about giving the totality of our lives over to God. So not just our spirits, but our whole sense of being, our whole minds. But the language, there are words for that you can use to say that. There are words that say, give your everything. But that's not the word that's in play here. The word that's in play here is give your bodies. Give your physical selves. Which doesn't exclude the other things, but it's a specific call. It brings it right home for us. It brings the act of worship into our bones, in our flesh, in our blood, in our breathing. And it says that what we do here matters. It says that we can't just think our worship, and even can't just believe our worship. That there's this reality that what we do with our hands and what we say with our mouths, all of these things are relevant and carry weight. And in fact, that's the mechanism through which the invitation comes. Give your bodies. And there's also a beautiful plurality in that. Your bodies. It's not just about me and God. This is a call to every. We are to come as a people and to bring a sacrifice, right? Offer our bodies. It's powerful stuff. There's other language here that harkens back to earlier in the chapter, sort of with some specific. In Romans 6. Verses 12 to 13, and I don't have this to bring up on the screen, but just listen to this for a minute. Therefore, this is again, Paul is speaking, it's the same letter, it's the same book in the Bible. Therefore, do not let sin reign in your mortal body so that you obey its evil desires. Do not offer any part of yourself, again, yourself, your body, to sin as an instrument of wickedness, but rather offer yourselves to God as those who have been brought from death to life, and offer every part of yourself to him as an instrument of righteousness. So there is a marriage here. It's not just about what we think. There's a working out in our bones that is significant and important. And Paul, and the point here is that he actually says, the thing that was the tool for your brokenness, the place where your brokenness reside and found its evidence, this physical thing, this is also now called in to be a tool of redemption, a tool of a worshiping life, an expression of it. It has substance in our bodies. And I really like this. This is from somebody who wrote, this was in, I think, the 30s. It says here, Paul's appeal was that their bodies would be presented to God as an indication that the work of Christ, the sanctification of the Christian life, is extends to that part of our nature that is most completely under the bondage of sin. So the place that we fight with our sin the hardest is called in to be a tool of righteousness. It's significant stuff. Let them be a living and holy sacrifice, the kind that he will find acceptable. Again, this is a significant language here. Offer your bodies as a sacrifice, living holy and acceptable to God. Now, some of our translations will, if we read this, it'll talk about offer our bodies as living sacrifices, or offer our bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable. But the original text actually says, offer your bodies as sacrifices, comma, living, holy, and acceptable. So it puts these three words kind of on an even keel, on a playing field. And it's a bit of a shift for us in our thinking. But I want to ask a question, and this is not a rhetorical question. I would like to get some feedback from you guys here. What comes to mind when you think of the word sacrifice? Just shout out some things. What are the image? What kind of imagery comes to your mind? Okay, giving up something. Death. What else? Sorry? Selflessness. What else? Covering sin. What else? Hard work. Yeah. Animals on an altar. Yep. Stretching. Sorry, what was that? Stretching oneself. It costs something. Yeah, it's actually pretty common use of, we use that word a fair bit, right? Hey, listen, I've made sacrifices so that you can go to school. What does that mean? Yeah. there's a bit of a guilt trip in that comment. And actually, it's interesting. We do often use that as a mechanism, right, where we'll use a sacrifice that I've made to make you beholden to me in some way, right? I've sacrificed this. Or I've made sacrifices, so I now deserve, right? I sacrificed, and this is not something that is true in my life at this point. But I've sacrificed coffee for the last 10 years so I can go to Mexico, right? Like, you know, there's a sort of, I sacrificed this so that I'm worthy of that, right? That's not really what Paul is getting at here as he talks about sacrifice. There is an understanding that would have been present in the first listeners of this text. And so I just want to talk a little bit, and please stay with me. This is not at all boring to me anyway. Repeat after me. Chris, this is not boring stuff. It's pretty It's like on a scale of enthusiasm, I'm going to give that like a 5.1, which is over half of 10. So that's good. So in the Hebrew context, their understanding of sacrifice, there were three what I would call classes of sacrifice. Now this goes back into the earlier law of Moses at Sinai and delivering of the Ten Commandments and the whole law, and that is a huge conversation. And I don't want to get too far into that, so I'm just going to kind of skip along the top of this a little bit and just paint a little bit of a picture, and then we're going to move forward. Okay, so this is not a comprehensive understanding of the sacrifices. The sin offering is essentially. Now, and this is also offensive to our modern sensibilities. We are not good with killing animals so that we can feel better about mistakes that we've made. That's not something that really appeals to us. We don't have a framework for what that is. But that was sown and woven into the understanding of the ancient Hebrew people. And there was a sense in the middle of it of responsibility. That's part of why there's death that's associated with sacrifice, is because there was an understanding that sin resulted in death, that sin was no small thing. And so there's a transference onto typically a creature, although there could be in a certain context you could bring other kinds of offerings, but there'd be a transfer of guilt, and then essentially you're watching something die in your stead, which is harsh. Vegans are not going to dig this language. But we have to have historical humility as we look at some of this stuff to understand what this language can mean for us. The other thing to recognize about offerings in general is that apart from one form of offering, we're also just talking about a barbecue here. We're talking about the preparation of food. Most sacrifices were eaten. And so unless we're really offended by the smell of barbecue, we're not really talking about something so very different from that in terms of the actual mechanics of the thing. In fact, I would say there's a very strong argument to say that these creatures were far more honored in their life and in their death than most of the meat that we would consume on a day-to-day basis that we'd buy from the grocery store. So that's not to moralize or anything, it's just to sort of create a space of, let's contextualize this a little bit. Okay, so the sin offering is kind of what I just said. There's guilt, we transfer in a symbolic way our guilt onto a creature, that creature is slaughtered, there's a process, and a portion of the sacrifice is burnt, and that's not to be eaten. That's considered the Lord's portion. And then the rest of that typically is for the priests to eat. It's food. And there are very specific criteria within the laws of how that gets worked out. But that's kind of the basic mechanism. The next class is the burnt offering. And this is something that is wholly for God. This is a scenario where what we bring, this is not for our consumption at all. This is just God's. This is God's offering. It's burnt. It burns like all night. They clear off the ash in the morning. Okay? And then the third class of offering is what we call a peace offering. And a peace offering, there's some different ways that this would apply into that culture. But essentially, a peace offering can only be given once the atonement, the sacrifice that's taken care of our guilt has been done, then we can bring a peace offering, and that's a celebration of a reconciled relationship. It's a celebration of the fact that we've been forgiven. It's a celebration of the fact that we're still welcome in community. And the really cool thing about a peace offering is that it is, in fact, a party. So the offerer gets to partake of it. The offerer's family gets to eat, the priests get to eat, and there's a portion of it that is burnt, and that is the portion that is given specifically to God. There's this real communal aspect that comes into it. There's something that's a beautiful idea, and I don't want to take this too far, okay, because I don't want to read too much into the text. Paul does not get specific in terms of what offering he's talking about. So let's just call this a bit of a thought experiment. If we look at the first half of Romans, it's not really the first half, but the first portion leading up to chapter 12 of Romans, we see the work of Jesus being pulled into these first two classes, right? Where he steps in and he has taken the weight of all of the things that disqualify us on himself. He has given himself over to death, right? There's a resurrection. We're called through that death into life, right? There's a whole story that's being unpacked here. This is why this is a huge topic to try to hit, because we can't just talk about one little thing, right? So if Christ has done that, and our understanding of that is a done deal now. We don't have to lean into those sacrifices. We come through Jesus. Jesus is the one who invites us out of every kind of personal disqualification, every kind of sin, into relationship with God, into relationship with himself, into relationship with the Father, into an experience of communion with the Holy Spirit. God has done this work through Jesus. Then what is left for us is this third class of offering, this peace offering, which has hospitality. We're going to sit down at a table and have a meal together. What does that sound like to you? Does that sound like the communion table at all? Right, where we are sharing together. There's a beautiful imagery here that calls us to the feast, essentially, that is celebrating the work of atonement. So this is not, the peace offering is not really about covering over our sins or making us right. The peace offering is about, at its root, at its core, is a celebration of the work that God has done. And so this idea that we then get called to come, I don't want to lean too far into this, but the idea is a beautiful one to me, that we come together as a people. We offer our physical selves onto this altar, which he calls us to have to be a living sacrifice. And then in this space, that is a celebration of the work of God. I think that comes pretty close to a lot of things for me. That really starts to unpack, in my mind, it's a beautiful image of what our worship can look like. Because if we think that by worshiping better, we're going to have more of the Holy Spirit, or by worshiping better, we're going to somehow get more of the favor of God in our lives, we've missed the thread. We've missed the plot entirely. We've walked away from this idea of what Jesus has won for us. And then we're trying to use this mechanism to win the favor of God. And our worship is not intended for that. Our worship is not intended to win the favor of God. Our worship, our response, our lives are about responding to what he has done. These three words, living, holy, and acceptable, I just want to unpack them briefly. We are going to come in. We're starting to land the ship here. For us to be a living sacrifice, we have to be pulled through the whole story of the work of Jesus. Because this is the thing, Jesus in previous texts in Romans and throughout the New Testament, we're called into death, right? We're called through death into resurrection life. So that this is a part of this language that we have to wrestle with and contend with. It's not just a feel-good story. Our worship is not just a feel-good opportunity, right? A chance to sort of sing some positive language and make us feel better about ourselves. It's actually, if we wrestle with it, it is a call through death into resurrection. Jesus has not called us to anything that he has not already demonstrated. Jesus is the perfect worshiper, right? That we are called into a holy offering. What makes our offering holy? Does that not sound a bit presumptuous? That we set apart this thing for God is what makes it holy, separate. It's basically what holy means, more or less. It's specifically for God. Which is why the entire Old Testament story of Israel coming into the new land and all this stuff and all the brutality of it, at the end of the day, whatever else might have been happening there, it is a war between God and idols to win the hearts of his people. Right? Holiness is to say, I worship you, and there's no one else who for whom this language belongs, to whom this language can belong, to whom this expression of devotion can belong. I'm not living for my wife. I love my wife, but I don't live for Liv. Right? Because that's making an idol out of my wife, which is really easy to do, by the way. I'm saying that that's the sound of a crash. The language is God's. The worship is God's alone. He's not in competition. That's what makes it holy. If I'm being duplicitous in my worship, then it becomes common and that's problematic. It's holy because it's God's. And that it's acceptable, this is the thing. The statement is that when you bring your life to God, in whatever form it is, whether it's broken and scarred, which is a whole other conversation with regards to the sacrificial system thing, but it is pleasing to God. That's what that statement is. It is not that we need to bring bodies that are made perfect and lives that are made perfect in offering in order to be pleasing to Him. It's easy to misread that. The call is that when we bring what we have and we offer it, we put it as a living sacrifice, a living offering to God, that it is that act makes it acceptable to Him. So there's a whole redemptive thing that is in that, that is beautiful. And a guy named William Noel says that any creature should be able to offer what could please the infinite creator is wonderful, but that such wretched fallen ones as the sons of men, he wrote this a long time ago, should do so is a marvel which only the gracious God Himself knows the depths. There's a sense that this is a mercy of God. This truly is the way to worship Him. The language here, it's the same, the Greek word is the same word that we pull our word logical from. It follows that given who God is, this is the natural response. This is the appropriate response. In fact, you could say this is the divinely reasonable response to who God is this worship. And again, the worship here, the word, there are several words that can be used for that. This means our service rendered to God. Right? As I was concerned, I did run over a little bit because this is a large conversation. I just want to read the portions that we've highlighted from Romans 12 again. And then I'm just going to ask the worship band to come up, and we're going to land this thing in the next 5 minutes, okay? So, dear brothers and sisters, I plead with you to give your bodies to God because of all He has done for you. Let them be a living and holy sacrifice, the kind He will find acceptable. This truly is the way to worship Him. What does any of this really have to do with our expressions on a Sunday morning? We are going to get into that a little bit more next week. We talk about what it is to have. I'm going to throw out a word. Don't be afraid of it. We're going to unpack it. An incarnational, sacramental life. This place of the offering of our lives, it becomes this area where we get to, where we weave this thread. I wrote this down, and I'm going to read from it because it's good. Seriously. Worship is this posture that sews up together our words and our deeds so that both of those things are connected and empowered, right? So that neither of those things become empty displays where we're trying to appease an angry God, or where we're trying to just be sentimental and feel good, or we're trying to strive and on somehow by being the best rootinist tootinist worshiper, we're gonna have Jesus love us just a little bit more. right? Worship, it, because we run the risk without being worshiping creatures. And by the way, we, that's a whole other thing. We'll touch on that probably in the third week. But we are worshiping creatures. But if we split that apart and we just become all about what we believe and think and feel, and that doesn't really bleed over into the lives that we lead, it doesn't matter what we think or believe or feel. It's kind of, it's empty, right? But likewise, if we are just living our lives in as perfect a way as we can, and we're engaged in all of the right kinds of activities, but our hearts are not there. If our hearts are not present in whatever good deed we are doing, it's empty. Worship empowers both of those things. Our acts of worship, this is the transformative power. When we weave these things together, we get to emerge from that space as intact people, as empowered worshipers, right? This is not about us living the best life we can. This is about us living the life that God is calling us into, which is itself amazing worship. Does that make sense? So I know we've kind of gone wide and big here with some of this stuff. If you have any questions, don't hesitate to ask or to like email or hit me up on Facebook or whatever. We can chat more about some of this stuff. But I just wanted to, I just wanted to lay down the core foundation of what we're doing and why we're doing that. And next week we're going to have a lot of fun. So, guys, can you come up? We're just going to sing. I asked Liv if we could sing that last song again. Pour it out.